Hello and welcome to a special edition of American Roots with Jacob Grootman and Eli Smith. We have Mike Seeger here in the WOBC studio. We're very excited, and he's going to be on the air in just a few minutes. I think we're going to just start right in and play the first track from his new album, which is not yet released, and a tune called Breaking Up Ice in the Allegheny.
Welcome to Down Home Radio. Well, we have a special edition of the show today. It's an interview that I did with Mike Seeger, and we're taking you into the archives here because this is actually an interview that I did for my college radio show in Oberlin, in Ohio. I went to school on WOBC. This was in the spring of 2003. I was a junior. And me and my friend Jacob had this radio show on the college station, and I was also booking the Oberlin College Folk Festival at that time, and I had booked Mike Seeger to come and play at the Folk Festival that year, which he did, and he came up to the radio station the late morning and early afternoon before his set and spent some time with us on the radio. This was my first radio interview, my first real radio interview. I was really nervous. I had a million questions and still have a million questions for Mike Seeger. I totally forgot that this show was recorded. Someone popped a tape in there at the station, maybe I did, and pressed record. And I was rooting around the other day at my parents' house, and I found this tape. And it's really, it was a good interview. It was all right. Mike is really thoughtful and easy to talk to, and we had an excellent conversation on a number of topics. I asked him about his family and growing up with Elizabeth Cotton, the guitarist and banjo player, who was his caretaker as a child. I asked him about various other musicians. I was very busy at that time, almost 5 years ago, trying to learn everything I could about folk music. And so I asked him about other musicians that he knew. I was into Paul Clayton, a folk singer from the 50s and 60s. At that time, I asked him about Paul Clayton, if he'd ever run into him. I asked him about Doc Boggs. Alan Lomax had died the previous summer. And at the time of this interview, Mike Seeger had been at, and I had also attended, a conference at Cooper Union here in New York on the life and work of Alan Lomax. So we talked about that in the interview. Mike played some gourd banjo and some jew's harp. I even hit him with some earnest general questions, such as his thoughts on the state of folk music in our modern era. Anyway, all this and more coming up on today's episode of Down Home Radio. From the archives, I decided to re-splice in the recorded tracks that we played in the show for the sake of audio fidelity. This cassette tape that I dubbed this from sounds, you know, pretty good, but not great. So I all the tracks that we played on the show, I've re-edited in from my CD MP3 collection. When this interview happened, Mike Seeger's album True Vine was about to come out, and he gave us an advance copy right there at the studio. So to start out the show, we played the first track off that, Breaking Up Ice in the Allegheny, followed by his version of The Cuckoo Bird. So I've been playing those behind my voice here. Let's hear the end of Mike Seeger's Cuckoo Bird off True Vine, and then we'll get down to the interview.
She's a fine bird, don't she wobble as she flies. She don't ever holler cuckoo till the 4th of July.
Well, there we had a couple cuts from Mike Seeger's newest album, which is not yet released, called True Vine. First was Breaking Up Ice in the Allegheny, and the second was, of course, The Cuckoo Bird. We got Mike all set up here in Studio B. We're very happy to have him. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
Cool. we're gonna ask you some questions and play some tracks. And Mike has been good enough to bring his gourd banjo, specially made in California, all the way out to Oberlin, where I guess the humidity's kind of different. It's a little bit messed
up. summer's getting here.
Yeah, yeah. And then of course Mike is going to be playing tonight, I believe, at 9 p.m. At the Folk Festival, which is currently held in Finney Chapel rather than in the park due to the freezing cold weather.
Well, I think that's the evening program that's going to be there. I believe some of the daytime programs are going to be out on the square, aren't they?
Hopefully.
Yeah, we hope so.
Oh, that's right. It won't happen for a couple of hours yet. So we're going to watch the weather.
Definitely.
Well, experience the weather.
Yeah, it'll be transcendental. I guess let me start out by asking you a couple questions about the new record. I had not heard of this. It's not out yet. Have you just been recording this?
Yes, I recorded it in my home
for
about the past year, and 'cause I have a recording set up there and some good microphones.
Cool.
And that's the way I like to do it. That's the way I've done most of my recording. If you're a soloist, like I am most of the time, you've been able to do that for about 40 years.
Okay.
Since the tape recorders got here, you just set up one microphone at home and record mono, because for a soloist, mono is almost as good as stereo. And you can do it when you want to and feel like it.
Yeah, right in the middle of the night. Well, that's cool. What was the impetus behind the new record? Did you have anything in mind, a gap and stuff that you had recorded before?
Well, every few years I like to have a recording of songs that I'm doing currently, or just to have I guess you'd say a representation of what my solo music is like.
Yeah.
And so from time to time I like to do that, and these are songs that really appeal to me, and they cover quite a range, from English songs to natively American songs.
Yeah.
A fair amount of songs from African American. Rural African American tradition too.
Yeah,
that Cuckoo Bird that we heard, second of those two tracks.
Yeah,
was played a lot by African American men in Virginia and North Carolina until very recently.
Yeah, I have that CD, Black Banjo Songsters, and I know there are a couple versions of that song, and they're really wonderful stuff.
Yes.
Did you know? I know. I've heard you talk about a banjo player named Josh Thomas. Could you tell me a little? I don't really know anything about him, though. Who was he?
Well, first of all, I have to say I never met the man.
Okay.
I wish I had. He passed in 1970. He was from around Roanoke, Virginia, which is kind of a little valley in southwestern Virginia, and a town of about 250,000 people now. Uh-huh. And I think he did the usual kind of work that black men did at that time, but he was blinded by this time. I'm not just sure why. Yeah. And he had a really broad repertoire of songs, all the way from blues that he probably learned from a recording to songs that I'm sure had come down to him from older African American and probably European American people too, that he adapted to the banjo.
Yeah, that's something that a lot of people don't even consider at all, that there's an African-American tradition on the banjo and on the fiddle, of string band music in general.
Well, there were black hillbillies.
Yeah.
Black country people who liked the same kind of music as white country people, and there's actually quite a bit of going back and forth, changing back and forth, because those that they played together at and in bands and played at one another's dances and so forth and so on, and there were differences sometimes, but other times you couldn't tell. There are some commercial recordings where you wouldn't know. In fact, I never knew that one of the musicians had dark skin. I mean, basically, that's what you're talking about here.
No, it's true. I should mention to the listeners that three of us from the Jug Band are up here in the studio, and we're big fans of I guess what you might call the songster tradition. We like a lot of those folks.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I'll just, play a Henry Thomas tune right now, and then maybe ask Mike a couple questions about what he thinks about that stuff, and maybe ask him to get out the gourd banjo as well.
Okay.
In any case, I'll put on a song called Bulldoze Blues by Henry Thomas, who's a wonderful, I guess sort of, I mean, I assume he played for square dances and other kinds of things in Texas way back about 100 years ago.
A friend of mine swears that he saw him on the street playing for money.
Oh, man.
In Texas in the, I think that would have been the 40s.
Wow.
And so I think that there's a good chance that he did that too.
He would have been quite old, or pretty old by the 40s.
Yeah. Well, let's see, he recorded in the late 20s.
Yeah, and he was in his fifties, I think. I mean, I don't know. I've only read the notes to this album, but it seemed like he was older already by the time he was recording. So yeah, I mean, he could have been quite up there. Who did that? You know, said they saw him.
He's Bob Durham. He was the son of a fiddle player from Illinois, and he just we got to be friends in the '60s, and he knew some old time songs from his parents and sang them.
Wow.
Anyway, let's hear Henry Thomas.
All right, I'll throw on the track.
I'm gonna wait, babe, and it won't be long. I'm gonna wait, and it won't be long. I'm going wild, never getting blue.
mill.
Well, that was Henry Thomas with Bulldoze Blues, which Canned Heat covered. I have actually haven't heard that. Jacob was saying that it's pretty good. They do it pretty well. He's a real cool old musician. We were just speculating about just how old he is. I had thought that he was probably born in like the 1870s, and then recorded kind of later in life in the late 20s. I'm not sure for what label or how that came about. I don't know. Do you know if anybody has done any like scholarship on Henry Thomas?
It's very very sparse, and I think the only person that did it was he lives in Texas. The name doesn't come immediately, but there's very little known about Henry Thomas's life, where he came from, or anything really. And he recorded, yeah, I think, if I'm not mistaken, for Vocalion. And didn't he have more than one session? I think he did.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
Which is
amazing when you consider what it took to be in touch with record companies to make a record date, you know, in those days. You had to be able to be in touch with them, have an address, and
yeah,
have somebody write a letter, and
yeah,
no phone. People didn't use long distance phone very much then.
But you figured Henry Thomas would have been playing for square dances and stuff, and for both whites and blacks.
I really don't know. Yeah. I believe he would have been a street musician.
Yeah.
At least in part of the time.
Yeah. Well, what was it like growing up with Elizabeth Cotton? What was she like in the everyday?
For those of people who don't know who Elizabeth Cotton is,
yeah,
she was a brown-skinned woman. She was from the African-American community around Chapel Hill, North Carolina, which is a college town. And she, for her living, what she did was what most black women do, which is take care of children, usually European American children,
yeah,
and do cleaning and ironing and so forth. And that's what she did for her living. And she was very particular about who she would do and who she would do for and what she would do. She was an unusual, I don't know how to characterize her. She was full of soulful grace.
Yeah.
A settled kind of person, although she could play the banjo, which you don't think a settled person would do. She was a wonderful dancer.
Oh, really?
She could do the Frisco and a whole bunch of other steps. She showed me when she was in her 50s and 60s. But it was just like living at home and having a woman who was just a member of the family.
Yeah.
She was like the members of my family.
How old were you?
Our family was kind of would-be aristocrats.
Yeah.
And she wasn't a would-be, she was.
She had that kind of bearing?
Yes. But she played blues on the guitar. We didn't know that when she came to work for us. My mother and she met by chance in a department store.
Oh, wow.
And I can just imagine those two very unusual women. My mother was a modernist composer.
Yeah.
And she was a good writer and piano player and a wonderful teacher. And so Ms. Cotton came to work for us after, you know, a week or two, and it was 5 or 6 years, I think, before of her being in our household before, on Saturdays only, by the way,
yeah.
Before we found out she could play guitar. And then from then on, Peggy and I would ask her, my younger sister Peggy, who's was a guitar player long before I was, would ask her to play. And then shortly after that, I got a tape recorder and recorded her first LP.
Oh, wow.
In her bedroom with her three great-grandchildren.
Oh, wow.
Listening.
Oh, that's wonderful. And how old were you when she came to
Did I say great-grandchildren? Yes, that's right, great-grandchildren.
Her great-grandchildren, mm-hmm. Wow.
In the 50s.
Yeah, wow. Here, this is kind of a jump of a question, but you were saying that your mother was a modernist composer, and I was just reading some writings by Charles Ives and Béla Bartók on what they thought about folk music and the use of folk music, and I was wondering if your mother had written anything or just if you could recall for us what some of her thoughts on the uses and you know, the meaning of folk music. I know I'm like kind of jumping a little deep, but did you ever talk to her about that?
Not that much. I just absorbed it from household conversations, and then I've read what she's written.
Yeah.
And I've read her biography, and sometimes it's hard to separate those things out.
Memory.
My father and mother had a mission, and that was to keep this kind of music alive because they believed in its inherent musical value and in its cultural value, because it's been a straight mouth to ear without commercial intervention until the 20s,
yeah,
when records and radio began coming into the place. Not that they're bad, it's just the cultural domination of those, the commercial domination of those that have skewed American cultural life. And they saw that happening, and so they brought us kids up with a counter to that, and
yeah,
refused to have a radio in the house, for instance, and they didn't buy commercial records except a few which were representative of traditional culture, which for us included Fats Domino and Mead Lux Lewis and
yeah,
and even Stan Kenton, I think, in the early days.
That's cool.
So they had a feeling of mission and it rubbed off on my sister Peggy and myself especially.
Yeah. And your father Charles Seeger, I mean, he
was part of that.
Yeah. What I've all kinds of, maybe I could just ask you, I'm jumping about, but I could ask you for another remembrance. Lately I've been getting into a folk singer from the 60s who is not terribly well known, I suppose, but I was wondering if you, as someone who I'm sure has known a whole lot of people over the years, could tell me a little bit more about him. Did you know a guy named Paul Clayton?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Where did you meet him, and where was he from, and what was he like? I've been enjoying his records very much.
I met him through a friend of mine, Bill Clifton, I think, or around through the folk music world of Washington, D.C., where I was reared. The folk song urban folk song scene consisted of a couple of dozen people back then in the 50s and 60s until about 1961 or two.
Yeah.
And so you knew everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
Or at least you'd heard of them and heard the gossip and or something about them. And I met him also through both the folk song world, our small world, circle of friends, and Bill Clifton, who's a he plays bluegrass mostly.
What does he play?
Older songs in bluegrass style, and he's recorded for Starday Records and Rebel and a bunch of other recordings ever since the early 50s, and they played together at the University of Virginia, where Paul Clayton and Bill Clifton both went. Paul did some collecting in rural Virginia, and that's probably where he got a number of songs, and then also he was a collector of songs from written texts as well. But he actually went out and saw some old-time people in rural Virginia. Interesting guy, but in a New England style, kind of performance. Except when he was with Bill Clifton, who played bluegrass. They were the Clifton brothers for a while, Bill Clifton and Paul Clayton.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's a wonderful Paul Clayton is a wonderful musician. I have.
We played a few parties together.
Yeah.
Hired to go on a cruise or something down the Chesapeake Bay or something like that.
You know, there's quite a small folk song scene, you might say, at least here in this town. And I'm from New York. And I look around there and I see a few people, but I mean, it's true. A scene can be a very small number of people, and really constitute something. I mean, back in the middle or late 50s, when you were looking around and seeing what was going on, I mean, did you think of yourself or all the people that you knew as anything, or just a bunch of people that you knew that were just kind of interested in the same thing, but just kind of hanging out?
I just took it as it came, and I never expected any of these things that have happened. And to me, the most interesting thing that's happened is that a lot of people younger than me have taken up various aspects of traditional music and are either developing it or carrying on just as the old time original people did. So and lots of fiddle players and a few singers, more and more singers now, and good banjo players all over the place.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful, and I never thought that it would happen quite as it has. The party scene in old time music for a while in the 70s was just, and in the early 80s was just absolutely amazing and wonderful.
Like
what did that look?
Here, Lesh, approach the microphone.
What exactly do you mean by the party scene? What did that look like? Because we're trying to revive something like that, and we're having some problems organizing it.
Well, folks just get together and play fiddle and banjo and guitar. Maybe they've gone to see Tommy Jarrell, or maybe they only one of them has, and the rest of them learn the tune from the fiddle player. Some of the best fiddle and banjo players that I know of went to Oberlin, and one of the people, David Winston and Brad Leftwich, both went here. Paul Brown, who's a wonderful banjo player and a good fiddle player too, they all have been part of the Oberlin scene. And back in the 40s and 50s, there were other musicians that I don't know nearly as well, but Joe Hickerson definitely comes to mind, who's a person who knows a lot of songs and still sings. a lot of them, and he worked at the Library of Congress Archive of Folk Song for, I don't know, 30 or 40 years, helping people access songs and recordings that only he knew, because he had an encyclopedic memory, really. He still does.
Yeah, he's a very cool guy. I've had the occasion to meet him a number of times, including at the conference on the life and work of Alan Lomax, which I went back to New York for a couple weeks ago, and I know and you were there.
Mm-hmm.
Which, yeah, I definitely like to talk to you about that. But I have kind of a funny recording here that I want to play, and maybe you can tell me about the guy who did this. This isn't music. This is comedy. And I've gotten a lot of laughs out of this. This is off Close to Home, which is a collection of...
Oh, I think
of,
I know what you're going to play.
Yeah. So all you listeners, check this out. This guy's really funny. And then maybe you could tell me a little bit about this guy and the circumstances of the recording and all that kind of thing.
Okay.
I'm going to make a talk on the world. From Adam and Eve to XYZ. Well, just give me a little wee bit of that old tune, Feed Your Babies Onions So You Can Find Them in the Dark.
There you go. Anybody got a guitar that I can just strum on? Hey, you don't have a guitar, fella, so I can play. I don't have nothing but a pick.
Well, no music, then you'll just have to take my word for it.
Well, Lost John's going to play it for you. He's going to play it in the...
Friends, Roman, cattle, and farmers.
Here it goes, right here.
My subject for this evening am entitled Why For, Wherefore, and How Come. But before I starts to commence to begin, there am some mighty important trifles that must be took into consideration before the main subject of the discourse am discoursed on this here elevated platform. Now, us must turn back the pages of history about 14,000 years to the time when Cleopatra and Julius Caesar were the headliners in the magazines and the moving picture shows. It is in them days that the people done thunk that the world was flat. Anybody here got a pancake in your pocket, I'll show you just what I mean. No pancake, then you'll just have to take my word for it. But they was all wrong. The world were never on the level. The world were always round like an apple. This epileptic shape on the counter of the axle, what done perforates through the middle of the center in congestion with the latitude of the horizontal. Now then, when the solar plexus of the sun's violet rays congregate on the middle of the bisection, there am set in motion the magnetic conundrum, which done reflex and defects and infects the roaring boralises of the North Pole where the pole cats live. Now then, that's what Christmas Columbus was up again when the Queen of Spain gave him a motorboat and told him to find the West Indies. He hibernates a lot of banana wagon pushers, sticks them on the boat, and he starts out. And he sail, and he sail, and he sail. And he sail for loads so long that they done run out of vittles to eat, and the men done run out of patience. Then Christmas had a wonderful procrastinating idea. He done called all the men on the quarterdeck. This boat didn't have no dollar deck. He had to call them on the quarterdeck. And he said to them, men, this is a doggone big ocean, and that's as lost as a sure shooting. Us been trespassing around here for a week, and the water looks here just like it did a week ago. Therefore, under the subsistence circumstances, us must do something desperate. Now tonight, when the night watch goes on the dog watch, the best thing to be there them to watch the dog star. Well, sir, that doggone dog watch that doggone dog star till the doggone dog star done gone home for breakfast, and they're still floating on the same ocean. Then Christmas had another wonderful procrastinating idea. He called all them men back on that two-bit deck, and he said to them, tonight, men, us will watch the Big Dipper, and when us catches up with it, us will get a drink. So that night, one man kept his eye on the bow meter, and the other man kept his eye on the Big Dipper. And in the year 1492 A.D., A.D., you understand, mean after dark, they discovered Columbus, Ohio. That's where the dark ages of history done stopped. Christmas done leave all his men in Ohio. He scoots back to the Queen of Spain. She done tapped him on the head with a sword and made him a knight. The men what stayed in Ohio got tapped on the head with swords and was made angels. That leads us down past the city hall to the scientific age, which am at the present instinct of time. When us compares the obnoxious ignorance of the folks of that time to the older, furious intelligence of the folks that live today, there ain't no getting around it. Us of today, I'm pretty doggone smart.
Look, astrology, physiology, psychology, and by golly, and all the ologies. This is some dology age. Does a man nowadays go out to study a little calcium mining? Not on your life. He studied a little calciminology. And on a Saturday night, does he go up to the country store and shoot crap? Not on your life. They percolates a little crapology. And did you ever stop to think what a great invention the radio am to the criminology and the welfare of the universe? Sure am a copious invention. All you got to do is sit right at home and revolvitate the dials and the music am preambulated through the atmosphere and comes right down the chimney onto your ain't him. And they'll think they used to thunk the world was flat. There ain't no exclusion for such grounds. Absolutely no exclusion. I hope that I've made myself plain and I thank you one and all. Now, give us that tune, Lord John.
Yeah, come on, fast tune. He doesn't make any speech in the world.
Play Cripple Creek, Lost John.
Who was that?
I've got his name there, but I don't know anything about him. I expect he would have been local for around Union Grove, and I have no idea
who it is. What kind of style do you think? Where did he get that?
I think it might have come off of a record. It's possible.
Yeah.
From one of those early talking records. It might have come out of medicine show tradition. It might have actually been written down somewhere.
Yeah.
Or he might have written it.
Yeah.
He had a wonderful way of giving it, you know. And this is in the latter. That was recorded in 67, and the man looked like he was about 60 or so.
Yeah.
So he could have learned it back in the early 20th century.
That's cool. Yeah, I've gotten a lot of kicks out of that. Well, I can throw on another record for a little while. And you were saying maybe you'd pick us a little bit of old Joe Clark.
Okay.
That sound good? All right, I'm going to throw on some Roscoe Holcomb. And we can get you set up in the next room.
Satisfy my wearied mind. Trouble in mind, I'm blue, but I won't be blue away, 'cause the sun's gonna shine on my back door someday. It's going down. If the blues overtake me, gonna rock away from here. Trouble in mind, I'm blue, but I won't be blue away, 'cause the sun's gonna shine on my back door someday.
Here we go. Well, that was Roscoe Holcomb with Trouble in Mind. And here we have Mike Seeger with Mike, what are you going to play?
Well, I just happened to seem, I seemed to be in the same key as Roscoe was for that.
Cool.
Thought I'd try old Joe Clark on the gourd banjo.
That sounds great.
With gut strings and no frets. Should play it a little bit more often. I kind of forgot how the second part goes. Old Joe Clark is one of the best known old time tunes that sometimes bluegrass people play.
Really?
And although they don't play it that way,
yeah,
the core of the same tune though.
Well, that's a real African instrument you have there.
It's patterned after the ones which came over from Africa, which are our first. Well, were our first banjos on this shore.
Do any of those survive, or they work from pictures?
A Dutch sea captain kept a banjo from the 18th century, the mid-18th wow. century, and it ended up in a museum over there, I think. That's, as far as I know, the
in
only
Amsterdam.
Thing that survives.
Wow.
Because, you see, they're totally organic.
Yeah.
And so they biodegrade very easily.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Very
yeah.
quickly.
Yeah. It seems like music in general would have been much, much quieter a long time ago because, I mean, everything had gut strings and,
mm-hmm.
and was, you know, maybe instruments were smaller or just differently constructed. And yet, I think it's hard for a lot of people to visualize these days that someone would sit down and start to play a banjo, you know, an old, like a small gourd banjo or something like that, and you would actually dance. It was dance music. And I think that's something that's lost on a lot of modern audiences.
Well, it was dance, but it was also music to make music.
Yeah, oh yeah.
So it could be music for entertainment of yourself or maybe just a few family members.
Yeah.
But not for a paying audience, really.
Yeah.
That almost never happened. The closest that it ever got to money, really, was if a guy wanted to have a special dance at his house.
Yeah.
For maybe...
like a picnic or something.
Yeah, maybe for 10 or 15 people.
Yeah.
Or maybe a family reunion or something like that at his
yeah.
home or her home.
And I guess there would have been somebody in every family that could play something one way or the other.
Most, you know, about half the people in this, in the musical communities in Southwest Virginia, Eastern Kentucky, and Western North Carolina, I'd say they could play or sing something.
Yeah, yeah. Even on very simple instruments. I mean, I know a lot of people played the diddly bow.
Could.
Which is, I mean, could even be a string attached to the wall. Or you were mentioning that you had brought along a Jew's harp,
mm-hmm.
which is another extraordinary. Extraordinarily versatile in some way, in a lot of ways, instrument which is very very small and easily constructed.
A lot of people just sing.
Just sing, yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. could I ask you to do a tune on the Jew's harp for us?
Sure.
All right. If we can play a tune, or if he's had it in his pocket there. Cool.
I've got one here that is a little bit like the first English ones, which came over here in the 17th and 18th century.
Oh, wow.
Went out to milk and I didn't know how. Milked a goat instead of a cow. Saw a chicken in the mud just a stomping on the ground. She hoisted up a foot and she danced all around. Turkey in the hay, turkey in the straw. Turkey in the straw, well, how do you know? I wake him up or shake him up or any way at all. Whoop him up a tune called Turkey in the Straw. I had a little chicken and she had a wooden leg. And I baked and I baked, but she wouldn't lay an egg. Poured hot water up and down her leg. And the darned old chicken laid a hard-boiled egg. Doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle-a You can kind of hear the tune there.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Turkey in the straw, and you play all the notes by adjusting the vowel sounds in your mouth?
Just by moving my tongue, kind of like when I do when I whistle.
Yeah.
And different parts of my tongue.
Yeah, that's really cool. And that one, now you have a metal one there. Did people make those out of anything else, like cane or some kind of wood?
Originally, we think that it came from Southeast Asia or from Asia.
Wow.
And they still do make them out of bamboo over there. And some places in the Soviet Union, they still make them out of wood, too.
Wow. That's really neat. I meant to ask you also about the Alan Lomax conference that I know we both attended a few weeks ago. I thought it was a tremendous success, a wonderful conference and tribute to his work.
Lomax was very good at collecting music, and that's, to me, that's the biggest thing that he did, was he got the music onto recordings and also brought it out where we could hear it. And I think I have an enormous respect for what he did just with that.
Yeah, I know that virtually everything I know about, I mean, his field recordings are unbelievably crucial. I think it's a contribution on world historic proportions.
Yes, absolutely.
As pop culture becomes as pervasive, I think it's like reaching its maximum, its point of maximum pervasiveness. And I'm also interested to see how that's going to work. It's beautiful to have these kind of testaments to folk culture, and it's amazing how absolutely on point John Lomax and Alan were so early on,
mm-hmm.
in the 30s. I'm looking forward to reading The Last Cavalier, which was mentioned. Have you seen that? Have you seen that book?
I've heard about it.
Yeah.
The Life of John Lomax.
Yeah.
He's Alan's father.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you ever meet him?
Oh, yeah.
What was he like? He's a real old school character.
Yes, he was. He's an old Texas character. By the time I got to know him, and I was only 8, 9, 10 years old at the time. I just remember this old geezer who came to visit us a couple times and sent us some postcards of horned toads from Texas, you know, and I thought that was pretty neat.
That is pretty neat. That's pretty cool. And did your father work with him?
Father and mother both worked with him and Alan.
Yeah.
And Bess, Alan's sister.
I was very pleased to have met her at the conference.
She's a great, great woman.
She's really cool.
She worked for the Smithsonian for a while, and then she had extraordinary vision, just like Alan.
Yeah.
But her touch was very, very much more diplomatic, and she worked with the National Endowment to get a great folk arts program going, folklorists for almost every state.
Wow.
In the Union, to start folklore collecting and presentation programs.
Does that continue to this day?
And a lot of them, most of them, still continue. And also for the National Heritage Fellowship Awards, which gives out kind of living treasure awards and grants every year to some of the best crafts people and musicians in our country.
Yeah. What do you think the status of folk music is today? I mean, that's a broad question. What I mean is the people that are playing this stuff are from stuff that you might hear on an Alan Lomax recording. The people that are playing it are from a very different set, a very different class, a different location than the original people. What do you think the status of folk music is today? Where is it at?
Well, whether or not we play music that's out of the mainstream that is more an expression of I guess minority cultures is about all I could say. It's more a matter of chance and choice now than it ever was, because everybody has access to the mass media, and the extent to which you turn off your TV and go and visit with your neighbors, or dig out old recordings and learn from them, or however you decide to take your path, is now a matter of choice more than it was before. It was a matter of choice before, of course.
Well, yeah.
But now it's completely a matter of choice. And you from New York and me from Washington, we're choosing to consider this music and take it into our lives. And of course our grandparents might have come from traditional communities, but now they wanted to get rid of it quite often.
Right. Yeah, they wanted to assimilate,
become part of the melting pot, which was the idea. And we've realized over the past 40 years that a balance of the melting pot and a pride in certain cultures and being able to make music for yourself is an important part of life, and that's our choice. And I feel very fortunate to be part of to have these choices and to have all these things. I regret all the passings of some of my great musician mentors. Because we'll never see anything like that again. We'll have fine music, but the experience and the depth of the music and the continuity of development through the oral tradition, it's just a different game now with all the electronic media.
I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about Doc Boggs and how you met him, and a little bit about his life. I know that was he involved with the Union? And you know,
he was from Southwest Virginia and reared in a somewhat musical family. And from earliest life he loved especially African-American music, and he would follow black musician soloists down the track or go to the black sections of a coal camp. There was a lot of African-American people who came to work in the coal camps of southwestern Virginia where he was living and working all the time. But he also had other musicians from the basically Irish, Scotch, German. Some of his folks were German.
Yeah, what kind of name is Box? I don't know.
I don't know. It sounds English to me, but I don't know for sure. And he put those together with a unique music sense and developed a style. He put those the European and the African musics together with his unique sense of music, and came up with a style that was totally unique. My father was in New York, and my father and mother, and part of New York Bohemia, and this artist from Missouri, who was a hip guy named Thomas Hart Benton, a painter, played him a recording of Doc Boggs and a few other people. And
a commercial recording?
A commercial recording of Doc Boggs. He made 8 recordings back in, he made 12 recordings back in the 20s. And they didn't sell real well except locally. And then a few people from out and away got copies of them. And they valued them highly. And I heard them when I was a kid because my father made a copy of those records.
Oh, wow.
So that I could listen to them.
Like on just an acetate or something?
Well, no. In those days, folklorists recorded directly onto aluminum.
Oh, on a, wow.
Onto a sheet of aluminum, a circular piece of aluminum. It was the latest thing. And that's what the Lomaxes recorded on for about the first 5 years of their of their field recordings. And it was handmade machines.
Wow.
Recording machines. And it gripped me, and I finally found Doc. He'd been working as a miner and retired. He'd worked for 40 years in the mines.
Yeah.
Came out with all 10 fingers in his mind. And the ability to still play some of the songs.
Yeah.
He had a second career. He didn't play much for shows back then. He did briefly for about 6 months or a year after his record came out.
Yeah. Yeah.
But prior to that, he just played for tips.
Yeah. Yeah.
And He liked to drink and carouse and work hard, and he liked to fight, you know, not to necessarily be angry, just to test his strength with people.
Yeah.
Like a lot of guys do. He's a big guy.
Yeah.
Big in every way, big in his mind, too. He loved he loved meeting university students.
Yeah.
Talking with young people. He just was tickled to death by that.
That's great.
Because he was a curious person, and he liked verbal give and take.
Cool.
And he could take almost anything you'd give him.
Yeah.
Just about anything, and he'd think about it a little bit.
Yeah.
Or think about it a lot, I mean.
And about his banjo style, was he a frailer, or did he lead with his thumb?
I only heard him frail the banjo or clawhammer once.
Yeah.
He basically did not do that. He picked with a thumb and two fingers almost everything.
Yeah.
And he had a couple of different ways of playing it's a particular style that I've not necessarily heard from anybody else.
Wow. Yeah, he had quite a unique and distinctive sense, and this is near and dear to me as a big Mississippi John Hurt fan. I was reading somewhere that Doc said if he could have started again, he might have like to play guitar like John Hurt.
Yeah, both John and Doc came and stayed with us for a day or two while they were doing
some
concerts.
Same time?
As I recall, yes.
Oh, wow.
They were doing some concerts together.
Wow.
Around Princeton and New York and Philadelphia.
That's a good show, yeah.
And so they spent a little time together, and yeah, I remember Doc saying that, actually.
Wow. That's what you just told me just blew me away, so I have to recover. Like I just mentioned before, I think pop culture is about to reach its zenith, its absolute like maximum point, and people are reacting to it.
It's hard to tell what's going to happen, and I think you just have to do like the Talking Blues says at the end, you know, the only reason I'm sticking around now, folks, is to see what in the heck is going to happen next.
Oh, yeah. Well, I believe it. Well, I think I'm just going to pop on a track from Rural String, an album called Rural String Bands of Virginia, and we'll take it from there.
Okay.
That was a cut off that record of Rural String Bands of Virginia. That was Sweet Sunny South, right?
Yeah.
That was a song called
Piedmont Log Rollers.
Say that again. Patterson's Piedmont Log Rollers.
Patterson's Piedmont Log Rollers.
That's a
Red Patterson's Piedmont Log Rollers.
That's neat. Well, Mike, thank you so much for coming out and spending time with us here on the radio.
It's a pleasure, Eli.
And we're going to let you go and crash, and I'm probably going to go crash myself. So I'd like to remind the listeners that Mike is playing tonight at 9 p.m. as the closing act of the Oberlin Folk Festival, which is going to be held inside due to the cold evenings here. So that's going to be in Finney Chapel tonight at 9 p.m. Thanks for bringing the gourd banjo and
sure.
the Jew's harp and lots of good stories and all kinds of other things. And we'll see you tonight at 9 p.m.
Surely.
Well, that does it for today's show. I hope to bring you more episodes of Down Home Radio from the archives in the future. See what I come up with. Mike played a great set at the Oberlin Folk Festival that night, and hopefully I'm going to get my hands on a copy of that and post that up along with this interview soon. And then after the show, he came over to my house, and we had a party going on there, and there was a whole bunch of old-time music, and Mike started buck dancing and everything, flat-footing. He's a great dancer. And me and my friends and bandmates and fellow musicians had just a wonderful time with him over that weekend. So I really have to thank Mike Seeger again for that. I've run into him, you know, a bunch of times since then, but that was really a fun, really fun experience. Hope you enjoyed the interview, and we will be back again, hopefully next week, with another episode of Down Home Radio.
And my shoes from a driver in the mine. Don't let the deal go down, little girl. Don't let the deal go down. Don't let the deal go down, little girl, till your last gold dollar.